I think we'll go ahead and get started. We've got a bashful bunch up here that, you know, shy and introverted that they are, you know. I think all of us in farm broadcasting are very appreciative of the relationships we've been able to develop with our state directors of agriculture. And it is important in our programming to be able to work with you and your counterparts. And we hope we can provide a service to you in getting your message out to the farmers in your particular states. And we're very happy to have a distinguished panel with us here. What'd you think of that? Distinguished. Mm-hmm. Like that? That's pretty good. Yeah. Pretty good, yeah. And what we're going to do, I'll introduce them just real quick, and then each one of them will make a short presentation.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And then after that, we're going to open it up. We're going to have a question and answer session. So let's get started. Down on my far left, we have the commissioner from the state of Louisiana, Michael Strain.
Thank you.
Michael, all right.
Thank you.
Next to him, we have from the state of Nebraska.
No, North Dakota.
I was kidding. I was kidding. I was about to say something about football, and then I was going to say you don't have football, so I was going to go to Nebraska.
I was afraid of offending Greg.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of us have known Doug for a long time in other capacities, and it's we won't get into that, right? From North Dakota, we're glad to have Commissioner Doug Goring with us. And the rose in the midst of this thorny bunch, we are very happy to have in the middle and coming to us all the way, of course, from California. We're happy to have Secretary Karen Ross being with us, all right? And from Louisiana, now... Do you know Don Molino by any chance?
Oh, on any given day.
Yeah. You don't speak like he does, do you? We have trouble understanding.
No, he has an accent. I do not.
All right. Please also want to welcome from Louisiana, Greg Ibach.
I'm from Nebraska.
You're from Nebraska. Well, who wrote this script anyway?
Don Molino.
Well, here,
that's
I tell you what.
He was answering.
You know what I'm going to do here? How's that? And I know where. Who else would wear purple unless they're from Kansas? Dale Rodman from Kansas, okay? Now, this is why they told me, just let them introduce themselves, because they gave me this script, I guess, all right? All right, we're going to start down on my far left. Dale wants to go last so he can have the last word, right? Okay, so go ahead and give us a few. We want to hear what's going on in your state. What are your priorities, some of your key agenda items? And then we'll go from there, okay?
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. How are we doing?
Good.
Good, good. I do a radio show with Don Molino, the infamous Don Molino. We're now on 50 stations every morning at 7:30, and we talk about what's going on. Just to put this into preference, yesterday, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, pushing back against recent criticism about the lack of farm support, suggested that farmers need to explain to the rest of America why the farm safety nets are good for the country. In the Wall Street Journal, the Obama administration released part of its climate action plan to help the agricultural sector better prepare. Also in the journal, the Congressional Budget Office reports finds $130 billion in savings from ag programs. What's going on in Louisiana? Some of our hot topics. We're now fighting citrus disease in urban areas. You ever try to find citrus trees in the courtyards of New Orleans? 80,000 trees trying to find those. We're dealing with Section 308 compliance orders in our poultry, our dairy, and our equine industries from the Environmental Protection Agency, reaching out, trying to discuss that not only with the farmers, but also with the public at large who do not understand why, quote, the EPA says farmers may be polluting the soil. The Environmental Protection Agency in total loads, total minimum diagnostic load, total maximum daily loads, and the compliance now. The big issue coming from the EPA and how, in Louisiana, the big issue is how we're going to continue to decrease runoff as we're at the bottom, right? The hypoxic zone is where? It's off my coast. And the Big Muddy, it used to be Big Muddy, now it's a lot clearer. Where's all that water come from? From the other states. But the big part of that issue is how are we going to do that? How are we going to decrease runoff How are we going to deal with the hypoxic zone at the same time as increasing production to feed not only the United States but the growing world? And how we discuss that, how we discuss that with the public. Another big concern is less and less understanding of the general disease theory by the public. The public thinks that when they get that the food from wherever they get it, that it is sterile. No matter what you do, nobody's going to get sick. We're looking at the Food Safety Modernization Act now. I'm trying to explain that, but also to further to educate the public about their part and their responsibility. We're dealing with a concerted effort by much of the mainstream media to downplay the national and international security interests in the advancement of GMOs and other science-based technologies necessary to avoid worldwide social, economic, and political upheaval and the eventual human suffering that will surely occur if we fail. Yesterday's Wall Street Journal: genetically engineered foods a plus. Now, you want to know what one of the great issues of our time is, especially for me back home. No one denies that we have to double food production by 2050. That we have to increase it 50% by 2030. The United States is one of the largest breadbaskets of the world and feeds a great deal of the world. With that being said, there's a continual push. And every day when I give speeches, and a lot of time somebody got up yesterday and said, "You mean you're pro-GMO?" I said, "I absolutely am." I look at every type of agriculture, whether it is organic, traditional, hydroponic, aeroponic, backyard, front yard, industrial, all together. And we know that there are many entities, and they put a lot of stuff in literature talking about pushing against the GMOs. We all know that without GMOs, we'd have to have another 37 million acres in production right now just to produce what we're going to produce. So at the same time, we have to lean forward and embrace these technologies. We have to have all of our research institutions lean forward and invest money. And we politically, right, you want to do something politically incorrect? Talk up GMOs to non-ag people, right? Yeah. But we have to. Failure is not an option. So the same group that was jumping on me about GMOs, I said, "Okay, what's your solution?" "Well, we don't know." I said, "That's right." So our path is clear and our duty is clear. And what we have to do in the media is we have to explain that consistently to America and worldwide, because, again, failure is not an option. And also what we're doing, we are coordinating a fresh and local movement centered on local and home production. And we're doing that talking about it culturally. We're trying to make it the hip and fun thing to do. But we're doing it for a number of reasons. Are we doing it for just because of the cultural aspects? Yes. Are we doing it for nutritional aspects? Yes. Are we doing it to increase local production of foodstuffs? Yes. But we're also doing it as a way to educate people about agriculture in general. If you want to get a homeowner to understand a little bit about agriculture, have them plant some tomatoes, or have them plant some cabbage or broccoli or corn and start that backyard garden. And so there's a constant effort through all of the different modalities is that we have got to start controlling the dialogue, because we have something to say, something that is very important, and something that we have to say because many people's lives depend on it, okay? So that's a snapshot of Louisiana.
Okay. All right. Well, I almost feel inclined to go and give an intro for my my colleague from Louisiana, because he forgot to talk about himself a little bit, but he is a veterinarian by trade, and he is one of the resources that I tap every once in a while at the national level. He is a good guy. And
thank you.
I appreciate all your hard work, and actually I really appreciate the interaction that I get with all my colleagues, because they all bring something very unique to the table, and something that I was going to get into a little bit is about the fact that we all have similar programs, but they're different. And it's a bit about a little of the resources we manage and the things we do. I want to give you just a little bit of background about North Dakota, some of our programs, some of our issues, run through those things very quickly because I know we have a limited amount of time, and quite frankly, just like Dale, I could probably give a half an hour, and I'm not going to do that. But I actually love questions more than I love to give a presentation. But I will tell you that born and raised on a farm. In fact, my son and I still farm a 2,000-acre no-till farm in North Dakota where we do spring wheat, winter wheat, barley, canola, flax, sunflowers, corn, and soybeans. And we are living, or I'll say I'm living the dream and experiencing the nightmare, just like my colleagues are. So I get to bring that perspective to the job every day as I advocate and regulate this industry, just as my colleagues do. The other thing that's just a bit different that I have in my backyard and in my position from all my other colleagues is constitutionally and statutorily, I have some other duties. I serve on about 80 boards, commissions, and councils in the state. I actually delegate about half of those approximately. The other half by constitution, by statutory, or by interest, I continue to serve on because I do love them. We have the Industrial Commission, which oversees oil and gas production in the state. I have that in my portfolio. So about 45% of my time is oil and gas, Water Commission, water, Upper Great Plains Transportation Institute, so infrastructure, railroad, roads, bridges, trade office and some of the activities there. We've expanded our trade portfolio in North Dakota. We're now exporting to 73 countries, which probably doesn't even compare to my colleague from California. But we do grow over 50 or produce over 50 different commodities in North Dakota. And it's a tribute to those people, our whole topography, the 10 different microclimates that exist in the state, and some of the unique situations and conditions in which we grow and flourish in production agriculture. I am elected, and we are very cognizant, I am very cognizant of some of those concerns that our constituents have and work with a lot of my colleagues to address some of those things. I talked about some of the similar programs, but I will say that there are areas of deep concern for us because sometimes the federal government tries to weigh in and deal with some of these issues if they feel like states aren't. First and foremost, I will tell you that North Dakota is the number one honey producer in the nation. Well, with that, that means we have an awful lot of bees, beekeepers, and wild pollinators in the state that are very beneficial to production agriculture in the United States. I think actually serving over 90 different crops, and especially almond orchards in California. About a year and a half ago, we got into this issue. We started to look at how we can mitigate and minimize impacts to agriculture and mitigate risk to bees, knowing that if we don't, EPA and USDA has and is intended to, or at least fully intended to say, that they will put something together. We got out in front of this thing. We started developing a plan, engaging the industry, farmers, applicators, agronomists, beekeepers, the motoring public, municipalities, and some of those other public entities out there that have a deep amount of concern for pollinators in our state and in our nation. And you would say, why motorists and why municipalities? We actually had townships and counties that wanted to zone out bees because of the issues surrounding them. Motorists that are trying to, especially motorcyclists, that are trying to ride their motorcycle on secondary roads, primary roads, and dealing with bees. We've had to come to a level of understanding, which is there's an importance here, and we're not going to try to zone anybody out. We've stopped some of that, but we've also had to make sure that we told them we're going to put some best management practices in place. And I know that there are other states now that are looking at some of the similar work that we've done. We've actually shared some of our information with them so that they can start to see that there's a way to address this issue. I will also tell you there is an anti-pesticide movement out there that has hijacked this issue on colony collapse disorder. When you look at the studies that have been done, what USDA did in 2006 or 7 when they put the colony collapse steering committee together. They identified its nutrition, its stress, its parasites, its diseases, it's the fungi out there. So whether you're talking about bacterial or viral diseases, those are issues. But it's also genetic diversity in bees. And last but not least, there are some pesticide exposures that are causing some problems. The problem is when you have a movement and activists that hijack an issue, all of a sudden the whole thing turns towards pesticides. We've shown, walked through, and are developing those types of plans that help mitigate some of that risk for those bees and minimize the impacts to producers. Because on the backside of that, understand they are guests. Beekeepers are guests on our land. And we don't want producers just shutting the door and saying, nope, you can't come here anymore. North Dakota is a safe haven for bees. And it's a concern of ours to make sure that we have healthy bee populations for all of our southern partners and West Coast partners to make sure that they can do a lot of the pollinating, which contributes to about $19 billion in production agriculture in the United States. The other issue that's starting to come to the forefront, and I guess thank God we started on this about 4 years ago, I asked the EPA for the authority to do Endangered Species Act plans. We were one of the first states about a year and a half ago to get that authority. I have a biologist and toxicologist on board. When there is a species that has been identified as being threatened or endangered, we have the ability to go and do risk assessments, take public comments, and develop plans. It has been working fairly good. Now that we are such an active state with a lot of oil and gas development, we have more and more activists on our front door, and we have more and more endangered and threatened species that they now want to identify and deal with. So it's putting us right at the beginning, right at the front of all this to start having these discussions and see how we can minimize these impacts to agriculture. Because instead of looking at an entire county and putting things in place that will impede ag operations from working and operating as they need to, we're starting to take it all the way down into sections and quarter sections along tributaries where there might be an impact or certain critical wildlife habitat. But it's making a difference. Just as my colleague had mentioned from Louisiana, Food Safety Modernization Act is a concern. That's another one of those issues that we become fully engaged in. We're not as infected as many other states such as Texas, California, Florida, Michigan, even Georgia and Alabama and some of those states that actually have quite a bit of produce. But we are affected to a point, and we may have a small dog in the fight, but quite frankly, we need to be there to support our partners because if fully implemented as suggested, we are going to compromise food security in this nation. Not food safety, food security, because we will put a lot of producers out of business. Trade is a big deal also in our neck of the woods, and with the collapsing markets, we need to be even more fully engaged in this issue. If we keep in mind 96% of the nation's or the world's population exists outside of our borders, 92% of all the middle class growth will take place outside of our borders, and 80% of all the buying power in the world is outside of our borders. This is about food security, it's about economic security, and in our own backyard, it's about making sure that we utilize all the resources at hand to also address issues with energy security to make sure we can stay globally, or that we can stay competitive in a global market. The last issue I'll mention is on infrastructure. With increased activity and thinking about how rail lines move throughout the nation into the Pacific Northwest for trade, we are a corridor for activity when it looks like corn and soybean and wheat production that's coming out of the Midwest going into the Pacific Northwest. We had the dissolution of the Canadian Wheat Board here in the, about 2 years ago. There's been some concern how that's going to impact capacity on the railway to complicate issues a little bit, but we didn't want to see bottlenecks also occur because of the extra oil and gas production that's taking place in North Dakota. We've been sitting down and visiting with BNSF and CP to make sure that we are addressing some of those issues. And although we've experienced some things this year, I will tell you we're probably one of the few states where they have poured an awful lot of money into expansion and maintenance to pick that up, to make sure that we can address some of those issues. We can continue to move supplies through the nation, out of the Midwest, but also those things that originate right there in the state, whether we're having grain shipments come in or they're moving coal and oil out. Things are starting to bust loose, and this year was a little difficult, but it looks like next year a lot of the shock will not be present as we've had to deal with this year. We'll be able to absorb a little bit of that with more double tracking, more side tracks, and we'll just have to continue to monitor those issues. It's important. It's important for ag. It's important for industry. It's important for commerce. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague from California. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, first of all, I need to establish my credentials. I'm from Nebraska. I own a farm in Nebraska. Now, the reason I start with that is because I know that there's a lot of perceptions about California and California agriculture. And a few weeks ago, I spoke to the National Association of State Veterinarians, and one of the gentlemen who had been there saw me in the airport the next day and said, "Great comments, but you really helped yourself by establishing your Nebraska credentials early." So I feel very fortunate to represent the state of California, and it is different, but of course farming is farming every place. I'm going to give just a snapshot of what we do in the state and why some of the things we do are so different from some of the other states. First of all, it's a spectacular place to grow things. We are very fortunate to have the climate that we do, multiple microclimates, the deep soils, and the foresight of people who came generations ago to put in the water system that we do. It is a spectacular place that now produces 400 different commodities. 80 of those commodities, California is the top producer of them, and there's probably 20 that are only grown in California. We grow over half of the country's fresh fruits and vegetables, a vast majority of the tree nut crops that are in high demand here and around the world. I'm going to just give you a snapshot of the things that I have in my agency, and then you'll say, but what do you really do to help agriculture? Our two biggest divisions are animal health, which is all about the milk safety program, as well as the prevention of animal diseases. And unfortunately, we've had too many experiences with that, including 2 years ago when I was traveling with colleagues in South Korea and got a phone call that we had a BSE case. And so I decided to leave South Korea before going to meetings that day. we also are the home of those 400 commodities, a vast majority of visitors who come to this country, five ports of entry. 50% of the goods that come in through our ports are destined for other locations in the country. So we grow things, and we get a lot of bugs in my state, and that's like the story of my life, and I cannot tell you how many eradication projects I have going on right now. We have a weights and measures program. We have a marketing division, which includes our dairy program, and I know that our problems with dairy right now have been written about extensively. Our inspection services program has our feed and fertilizer program, food safety programs, standards inspections for many of our specialty crops. We have the farmers market program, CSA program, direct-to-consumer programs. The state has its own organic program. We have a fairs and expositions division. It's the one thing that I have that I don't think any of my colleagues have, which is a challenge right now. And then we're supported by IT and administration. I am dealing with change of a magnitude I hope none of my colleagues have to, because when I came to the state 2.5 years ago, when I came back from Washington, D.C., I came back to taking a 33% reduction in my general fund support. That's a lot of dollars lost to one division with very little of it backfilled by working with our industry on some additional fees. We did it through a consortium process with our stakeholders to help us prioritize. We've eliminated many things that were nice to do. We've eliminated things that were important to do. But it also helps us focus on core functions, which is prevention of invasive species and animal diseases, because that's what keeps trade happening. In our state, that means trade going into global markets. It means being able to move our products to other states. and it means being able to move so much of our fresh produce just across county lines going into farmers' markets. So it's vital that we do that as well as we possibly can. I'm also dealing with an aging workforce, which is happening across every sector I can imagine. And now that the stock market's doing better, I'm starting to lose. I just replaced my third division director. So it's causing, you know, that instability. And when you see 30 or 25 years of institutional knowledge walk out the door, really focusing on mentoring and investing in our people to make sure that we can continue to service the agricultural industry. A couple of things that make us very unique is that you heard I don't have labor, and labor is vitally important to the many crops that we have because of the hands that are needed to do the kinds of crops that we have. I don't have water quality. I don't have water supply. I don't have air quality. I don't have pesticide regulation. And usually every group that comes to see me, when they talk about their top 10 issues, one of them is something I have statutory authority for, and that's invasive species. Everything else that impacts the farmer on a day-to-day basis is happening in my sister agencies. So I am very proud to say I'm a former lobbyist, because using charm and those kinds of techniques to make sure that my colleagues will return my phone calls is absolutely vital to our ability to flatten silos and really work on solutions and help inform the decision-making of our sister agencies. We used to have pesticides. Pesticide regulation was taken out of our department three administrations ago when we created our own California Environmental Protection Agency, which houses the State Water Resources Control Board. We're one of the few states, if not the only state, that have been given a delegation to administer the Clean Water Act in our state. That has the Air Resources Board, which is very famous across the country and around the world, which has been delegated complete authority to implement the Clean Air Act. Why we have some of the air rules that we have is because on any given day, either the LA Basin or the Great Central Valley, one of the richest farming sections of the world, have the country's worst air quality. When you are in a state that has 400 commodities and 38 million people, and just about every endangered species you can think of, we get into some pretty intense debates about how to do things. And pesticide regulations are there, and California is the only state that requires 100% use reporting on pesticides. We have our own registration system that is sometimes above and beyond what the feds do, and many of the standards that we do in California are above and beyond what the federal standards are. So that's an explanation of our environmental regulations. Water is our issue. If you know anything about the geography of California, two-thirds of our moisture comes in snowpack in the northern part of the state and has to move through our delta system to 23 million Californians and about 20 million acres of irrigated farmland. And our ecosystem in the delta is collapsing. So water availability is our huge issue. We're in our second year of a drought. We actually designed the system to withstand about a seven-year drought, but those were the days when we had a lot of row crops, less irrigation, so we were constantly getting groundwater recharged. We now have so many permanent crops going into the Central Valley. As long as we have bees, we'll keep planting those trees and vines, that the pressure on our groundwater is unbelievable. And that's where we're going to see a whole new level of regulation, I believe, in the next few years. And the Nebraska model gets held up continually. We also are in the midst of regulating nitrates in groundwater. And again, we looked at the Nebraska model. It was right up there with the Netherlands. And we're going to create our own because we're California. We're in the midst of climate change. We're one of the few states that not only talk about it, we're trying to do some things about it. But, of course, we can't do enough about it as one state. But because we do have mandates on reducing greenhouse gas emissions that have impact on agriculture, although agriculture is not directly regulated, it impacts us because of energy use. We are working very hard on creating protocols for offsets where agriculture is actually part of the solution because of the multiple benefits of well-managed working landscapes. We have a research roadmap for the needs of agriculture to continue to be able to be as productive as possible, and we just finished an agricultural adaptation plan. We're doing something about helping people understand that farming land, well-managed farming and ranching land, produces multiple benefits, much more than just the crop we harvest. We have defined ecosystem services. We have a qualitative assessment tool that's available to show our regulatory sister agencies how a slight change in how they regulate can create more benefits rather than less. And we have created an interactive database to really show the best practices of what well-managed working landscapes can do. We're very active in the farm-to-fork movement because we have over 1,000 farmers markets. Our biggest challenge right now is having enough farmers to fulfill the needs of everybody who wants to have a farmers market or create a new community-supported agricultural subscription service. Dairy's in trouble in California, and we learned this last year because of the drought. We have built our dairy model of being the most efficient, cost-effective milk producer in the country, and we've been very successful in doing that. And our dairy pricing system, oh, that's another thing that we only do in California. I get to set the price of milk. I'd like to give that up, really. But it got turned upside down last year because we have built our model on importing cheap corn from the Midwest using cheap energy. And that's not a model that probably is going to come back anytime soon, although I'm really glad to hear about those corn yields lately. I'm working with the dairy industry and hope that next year we will update our 50-year-old dairy pricing system. I probably will die trying it, but that's what I'm working on. And then finally, the ACP and the citrus disease issues, the pest population as we knew it would has finally gotten into the Central Valley, but we're actively working to eradicate it there, investing a lot of money in early detection for the disease itself. This is a disease that is actually similar to what I worked with when I was president of California Wine Grape Growers. A pest vectors a disease that kills the vine or tree. It's devastating, and it makes it highly unusual. Like Pierce's disease in grapes, Wanglong Bing, that's vectored by the agent Citricillin, has never been cured. But we're investing a lot of money. Florida, Texas, California in particular. Welcome Louisiana to that battle.
Thank you.
It's a big one, and that takes a lot of our time. I just want to close with stressing what my colleagues have already talked about, the importance of communication and bringing transparency to what we do as regulators in agriculture and what we do within farming itself. We believe this is a unique opportunity with the interest in health, nutrition, and locally produced foods. This is an invitation for a conversation to really engage people with what we do, where it comes from, and who is growing their food. Now, sometimes it seems like they're accusing us of things when they're really just innocently asking questions. And it's easy for me to feel defensive, but I think it's a fabulous invitation to engage. And the flourishing of social media and trying to understand how we can also play a role in that is probably one of the most important things we can do to maintain the technologies that we need, and to really help the public understand the diversity of agriculture with the variety of farming systems we have is one of the most important things we should all work to maintain. It's not about either or. It's about the full spectrum of what we bring to the marketplace to ensure that consumers can make the choices that they want to make and not let them take one off the table to the exclusion of the good of many. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. My name's Greg Ibaugh, and I'm the Director of Agriculture in Nebraska. And just like Doug, I try to lead a dual life, and we still have an active farm and ranch operation in central Nebraska. And, when I came in as assistant director in the department in 1999, it seemed like it, there were things would slow down at the department. We'd be a little bit cyclical, and we could kind of match that with a little bit of the work and not so stressful. But as things have now advanced, it seems like that whether it's the internet or email or social media or whatever has made the need for immediate information, immediate responses, we no longer have a slow time at the department. So it's made burning the candle at both ends a little bit harder over time. But I enjoy it, and it's a great opportunity for me to serve the industry that I love and that I'm part of and that I hope my children return to. I have three children, triplets, two boys and a girl, that are seniors in college this year. They're going to go out into the world and try real jobs for a while, but they all three have expressed an interest in being active and involved in the farm at some point in time, and so we look forward to that at home as well. I think, you know, maybe what I will talk about is this past year, we've, in the department, focused on three key vision areas, we'll touch on those a little bit and then move on. But, you know, one of those vision areas is to really be able to help, is trying to get us to be able to set the vision and set the tone for what Nebraska agriculture is going to look like in the future. And the first one that we've been focusing a lot on for the last few years, but we really stepped up our rhetoric about it in this past year, is our youth and providing knowledge and understanding about the career opportunities there are in agriculture. And these aren't just career opportunities in production agriculture. They're career opportunities that go way past, way outside the bounds that you think of being a traditional ag career opportunity. And they're not just for our rural and small town youth. They're for youth that live in Lincoln and Omaha. They're for youth that are interested in science and math and biology, and which I guess is a science. That shows how good I am at that. But, you know, they're for kids that have never thought that agriculture might be relevant to them. There's opportunities for them right now. And so we host the nation's longest-running youth institute, our Nebraska Agricultural Youth Institute, each year. This year we had nearly 200 kids attend that institute. We're focusing for next year's institute on trying to invite and lure some of those more urban kids that probably will look at us like we're crazy when we ask them to attend an agricultural institute, but we're hoping to bring them in to help them become aware of the opportunities that are there. And so, you know, it means that we're going to also then move into our second goal, which is trying to use these jobs and these opportunities that are emerging in agriculture to help us build our rural areas and our smaller communities. Because we really think that there's a great opportunity for us to look at what we do very well in Nebraska. We're a great livestock state. We're a great corn, soybean, and raw commodity state. But what we haven't done very well is tried to layer up on that. And we hope to be able to look for opportunities to do that. You know, there's been a real tendency here in the last few years for, you know, corn farmers and soybean farmers, you know, to become, you know, we used to have lots of diversified operations in Nebraska, and now we're becoming a cattleman, a pork producer, or a row crop farmer. And if that's our future, if we're going to, you know, quit having variety on our farms and then the farms start growing into 3,000 to 5,000 acre operations, that means we're going to drive families from our rural areas, and because we're limiting the opportunities. So I think that one of our focus areas is to talk about layering up with livestock. And even though we're a great livestock state, I think we haven't really even touched the potential for what we can do to grow our livestock industry, to create jobs and opportunities to bring a son home to the farm, a daughter home to the farm, to be able to have those livestock operations need services, veterinarian, nutritionist, consultants in communities to be able to strengthen our rural areas. And so that's really become a focus area for us. And then finally, this year we focused a lot about, livestock's one use for our corn and soybeans that we produce. But we also have, in Nebraska, we've been behind many of the states to the east of us and like California in adding value to those commodities through food processing. And so we think there's opportunities to look there in industrial uses as well as traditional food uses. And we've partnered with the Paulson Institute for the last year. Hank Paulson is a former Treasury Secretary. He now runs the Paulson Institute out of Chicago. And one of his areas that he's focusing on, and the one that we're cooperating with him on, is looking for opportunities to go to China, to look at companies that are worried about China's ability to feed themselves, but also worried about looking for opportunities to address China's food safety concerns that they're developing more and more every day. And it seems like every week there's a new food scare, a new pet food item that isn't made properly, that's dangerous to the consumer. And so we think there's opportunities to find Chinese companies that are cash flush, to be able to bring them to Nebraska, partner with Nebraska companies to create food, value-added opportunities for manufacturing and jobs here in Nebraska. And it's been a really interesting. Traditionally, that would have been a role that DED, the Department of Economic Development, would play in Nebraska, but the governor asked the Department of Ag to head up the partnership with Paulson, and so it's been very interesting to watch the interest develop. And I think this is going to be a rewarding experience. We're very optimistic about the progress we're making. No announcements yet, but it's a year, and you got to build relationships with Asians, but I feel very good about where we're headed there. And so finally, maybe to wrap it up, agriculture is transforming. Our rural communities are transforming. And so part of that means that we not only have to talk to the world about how we produce our food, and they have questions about how we produce our food, but we also have to focus even in a small town like Sumner, Nebraska, with 250 people, where my farm and ranch is located, where my children went to high school. Of the 16 kids in their class, there's only four families that were traditional ag producers. The rest of them were maybe related to agriculture, but they might have worked at the co-op or some other service industry in town, or have a manufacturing job in Kearney 30 miles away. And so those are kids that, you think, they know what farming's all about. They're from Sumner, Nebraska, but they don't know what goes on, as you're planting that corn. They don't know what goes on inside the pig shed. They don't know what goes on in the feedlot. So we have questions even within small communities like that we're having to address. And so, I think that at the end of the day, what we as farmers and ranchers in Nebraska are trying to do is trying to reach out to all facets of our state, from the urban to the rural areas, to let our consumer neighbors know that we're families just like they are, that we have the same kind of goals and aspirations, but our heritage and what we're doing is we're trying to raise safe, healthy food for them as well as our families each and every day. And that, we want to be, we are, I think if you get to know us, we're the type of people that are in your neighborhood. We're the type of people that you would like to sit next to in church. We're the type of people that you want your kids to play with on the playground. And I think that many times that's all that the public really wants to know about agriculture. Yeah, they may ask you questions about that you think are demanding some kind of a big scientific response, but I think Karen can share with you that sometimes that big scientific response maybe creates more questions and more scare than it actually offers explanation. And so I think we have to be careful how we venture into that. And so with that, I would close my comments.
Thank you, secretaries, commissioners. It's a pleasure to be here. And this is really a tough act to follow. We do all the same. No, not quite. Department does something differently, like Dr. Strain fights forest fires, and I don't think he told us that.
I do. I'm but state forest.
Piece of ag news, really. Piece of ag news just out today. And it's agriculture news because Oklahoma State's an agricultural university, I think. But they play Texas Saturday. And Wednesday night, the big left tackle on the University of Texas team come into Mac Brown's office and said, "I flunked. I can't play Saturday." Mac, as you know, has been under a lot of pressure. He immediately was quite concerned, so he called up his buddy, Velas Dodds, who's retiring. He says, "Velas, I cannot beat Oklahoma State with this tackle gone." Velas says, "You know, Mac, we got this program. You know, we got this program where we have a one-time-a-year opportunity for somebody to redeem themselves, and I get to administer the test for the redemption. So just bring him over to my office, and let's see what can happen." And Mac is really nervous. The kid's nervous. And so they get over there, and Delos said, "Just sit down, and I'll give you the test." And he said, "It's one question, and you have to do one thing, and that's spell the word cat." And the kid struggled a little bit, and he said, "C, and A, and then T." And he said, "Cat." And Mac Brown said, "Let him try again. Let him try again." So that's this has been a pretty dull meeting, really. So, we had this farmer out in western Kansas, and he, kids are gone. Him and his wife, they're pretty successful, and they're getting early 60s. And one night after dinner, they're sitting around the dinner table, and she looks at him, and she says, "You know, if I die, are you going to remarry?" And he's sitting there thinking. He says, "My gosh, that's a loaded question." And he said, "I really don't know what to say." But and he said, "Well, no, I wouldn't get remarried." And she said, "Well, don't you like marriage?" Dead silence. He had to think a while. Pretty soon he says, "Yeah, maybe I might get married." So again, it's dead silence, quiet quite a long time. And pretty soon she said, "Are you going to let her live in this house?" And he thought for a while. He said, "You know, we put new windows on the upstairs last year, and the roof's only 7 years old. Yeah, I think I'd let her live in this house." So it's dead silence pretty while, and she said, "You going to let her drive my car?" He thought a while, and he said, "You know, we did put new tires on. It's only got 55,000 miles on it. It's a good car. It's been tuned up. Oil's changed. I've done that. Yeah, I'll let her drive your car." Pretty soon, she said, "Are you going to let her use my golf clubs?" And he said, "Heck no, she's not going to use your golf clubs." She said, "Well, why not?" She said, "She's left-handed." So, I'm sorry, I shouldn't do that. But, you know, the Kansas Department of Agriculture, I'm going to talk a little bit about some more specifics, some of the things that we're doing. You know, my background, I'm the oldest person up here in the rookie in being an Ag Department Secretary. So, and I really don't know how to do this job. I've just been kind of plugging around for 3 years. I was in retirement. The governor called me and said, "You know, agriculture has been at the state level, and the Department of Agriculture has been really downsized for a number of years. I want you to come back and raise awareness of agriculture for the state of Kansas." And a really good opportunity. I talked to my wife. I was living in Texas. We have four golf courses. Still have a home down there, northwest Austin, the Hill Country. And she said, "You know, your golf game's not too good. Maybe you ought to go try that for a while." So I came to Kansas 3 years ago. I'll be 3 years in January. Got to meet these good folks here. But we took a look at what we're doing and how we're doing things. And, you know, agriculture is the largest industry in Kansas. We're the first land-grant state. It'll be the largest industry in Kansas 50 years from now. Like, we're very much similar to Nebraska. We're a big cattle state. We have a varied weather pattern from 16 inches in the west to 42 in the east when it rains. In the last 3 years, it hasn't rained very much, and we've been in pretty much a big drought, primarily in western Kansas. But our exports are great. And thanks to Doug's help over there, we've been exporting some live cattle. We've had over about 50,000 live cattle gone to Kazakhstan and Russia, Turkey, and they're not all beef cattle, but some dairy cattle as well, last few years. So I thank Doug for that business.
You're welcome.
And when I got to the agency, it had been really downsized and to the point, like, we only get, I heard somebody talk about money, we only get 16% of state general funds to run our agency. It's about 500 people, and it was really just a regulatory agency, but with a lot of good, solid people in it. And so one of my jobs was to do a little bit like Greg talked about Nebraska. It's where we want to go several years from there now, because that's basically my training was to, I come from the business sector, which is, hey, how are we going to get anywhere if we don't know how where we want to go? And I've always used the example, if you and I both want to go to Chicago today, and Greg gets out, he gets out his roadmap and he plans where he's going to go, and he gets his credit card and he gets some extra cash and he knows where he's going to get fuel, and he knows what highway he takes, and I just get in my car and take off. Even though he may go through Omaha, he's going to get there before I do. And so one of the things I found in a state, at least in our state, that there wasn't a lot of planning. And you can say, well, how can you plan for all of these independent people, because this is not a socialist republic out there? And I counter that with a lot of thoughts, because there's ability to change things by using the bully pulpit, getting up and talking about what we ought to do and where we ought to go and how we want to go do it. And it's been somewhat effective, and Kansas has begun to change quite a little bit. Some of the things we do that other states don't do, we inspect all the restaurants in the state of Kansas, which is 17,000, and we have all the hotels for bed bugs, which are 10,000. And a few years ago, before I got there, Kansas cut the funds for the bed bugs, and all of a sudden, Missouri was announcing that the Missouri hotels do not have bed bugs, and Kansans do. By the way, most of them do anyway today. But so it's a tough job.
In Missouri?
And like everybody else, we have weights and majors, fuel pumps. So I tell everybody that we touch everybody in the state of Kansas, and everybody in the state of Kansas is our customer. And for the businesses and the people in agribusiness, we can either make them or break them. And if we want to, as a regulatory agency, we can raise hell with them. So our job is to live within the statutes we have but keep them in business. That's our first objective. Our second objective is, if they want to grow, and gosh, we need to grow, because you know what the job situation in the United States is, we got it. We do everything we can to help them grow. And third, like the other states, we're scouring the world, scouring other states. We're scouring, looking for capital, jobs, businesses to bring to the state of Kansas to make it grow. You know, agriculture is in the process of major change, and it's been going on for 15, 20 years, but it's compounding itself. Anybody knows about Moore's Law, which is basically the speed of information doubles every 18 years, which has been driving the microchip industry and everything else. And agriculture is really in the throes of it. It's somewhat like the dot-com craze of California a number of years ago, if you really step back and look at it from a distance. And one of the things that we have is, one, because of a cheap dollar. Second is we're good at what we do in the way of how we produce things and the cost structure that goes around it. And today the profitability around it, that there's huge amounts of investments going into agriculture. This is so necessary for the future, whether it's GMOs or whether it's GPS. And so the only way we're going to get the job done going forward is with technology, as some of the other folks here have said. And so you can look at agriculture in the Midwest as a really a new dot-com craze that's going through the system. It's not going to burst like the last time, because for the first time, we've got a solid set of markets out there around the world, outside the United States, as people go into middle class. But so we have to be very smart what we do going forward. Thank goodness we got $4 corn now and not $7 or $8 corn, because that greatly, greatly balances the system out, and it's going to keep the land prices down, and we're not going to have the 70s and the 80s all over again if we manage ourselves properly. Again, the demand for animal protein is astronomical going to be in the world. I was in the food business a number of years, and there's certain things that are pure. At a certain GDP level, people quit eating cassava or starch and start eating animal protein. It might be a piece of chicken and a cup of soup on Saturday night, but those curves are basically pure. Only exception is the Muslim population and pork. And they usually move to pork and lastly end up to beef, which is a premium product on the shelf. And milk protein fits in there very, very, very nicely. So we have the opportunity in front of us to begin to change things. There's a lot of factors for my state and the Midwest states, Doug State, South Dakota, Nebraska, Oklahoma, is because of many of the other factors affecting, let's call it scale agriculture. There's going to be a movement in the future that's going to be in this section in the United States. There's a thing called urban encroachment. People want the food, but they don't want to see the animals. Kansas has had an nutrient program environmentally in place long before the feds even came down the road. We've spent over $400 million in soil and water conservation in the last 40 years. And actually, we have capacity for nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus in our systems. And no, we're not running it into the Mississippi, because most times it just goes right into the ground. So that's one of our opportunities. Now, our challenges are a couple, three, four things. We are blessed with a set of antiquated, unconstitutional corporate farming laws that's preventing investment, preventing opportunities that we have worked to try to clean up, but these are very much local issues that are very, very difficult to change. You're basically taking some things away. These laws were set up and revised 10, 15 years ago, primarily to keep the pigs and the chickens out of the state of Kansas. And they did a pretty good job. We only have 1.6 million hogs today in Kansas, although we've been actively trying to grow that. Milk size, we got 134,000 milk cows in Kansas. We are recruiting California cows. And our objective is they've got 1.7 million, and I figure they got one cow per 22 people, and we got one cow per 30 people. And we need more milk cows to get to the same ratio, and they should be able to let us have some more milk cows. Now, the problem is we have a dairy in western Kansas outside of Dodge City that's hauling milk from, he has a 7,000-head dairy he hauls to Birmingham, Alabama. With the antiquated milk pricing program we got, his freight bill is $850,000 a month. You're hauling 87% water all over the United States. And I haven't talked about the farm bill. I'm surprised these guys, gals, haven't talked about it, but it's critical in the future that this thing continues to get revamped. First off, we need to get one, and then we need to continue to revamp it. But we've been getting 8 to 10% growth in milk. We've built two processing plants the last year, and we're very actively working with China on the development of a new full-fat dry milk powder processing plant in western Kansas. And we have interest from two or three different places and actually some investment potential. Actually, I'll be out there all next week working on this project. The interesting part for Kansas is that over 30% of the world animal bioscience industry is between Columbia, Missouri, and Manhattan, Kansas. And for those of you on the technical side, the over 60% of the human diseases today are zoonotic. And so what this means is Dr. Strain is going to tell you if you're sick in the future by looking at your horse. Now, you think that may sound funny, but think about bird flu, swine flu, everything else. As people move all over the world, so Kansas... So Kansas has spent over $240 million working in the animal and human bioscience sector through what we call the Kansas Bioscience Authority in the last 6 or 7 years, which is located across the border over here in Kansas. In addition, we're putting about $300 million into the National Bioagriterrorism Center in Manhattan, Kansas, which will be over a $1 billion project, which is BSL-4 research facility for terrorist animal diseases such as hoof and mouth, anthrax, and things such as that. This work's been done at Plum Island off the coast of New York, which is antiquated, over 40 years old, and needs substantial monies. Kansas has stepped up the plate because we're in the animal business, and we figure this ties into our core competency, and it'll be sitting right next to our vet school, our BSL-3 facility at Kansas State University. We have a unique agriculture synergy in Kansas, and again, thanks to Karen in California, our ethanol industry, most of it goes to California. But because of sorghum, and over 60% of our ethanol is produced with sorghum, and our sorghum acreage used to be over 8 million bushels. It's down to 1.5. Last year, it's 2.3 this year. But sorghum, and especially sorghum, which is being produced in a system today, which we're using biodigester, using 500 tons a day of cow manure, gets qualified for the advanced biofuels standard, which California wants, and much of this is being supplied from Brazil at the present time. But Brazilian capacity is not going to come back in the United States. The DDG from this product works great for our animal feeding industry, but our challenges is the third factor is that the sorghum uses 60% of the water that corn uses. And for you that don't know, corn uses nearly 4,000 gallons of water per bushel. And, you know, we talked about the environmentalists or the activists looking at what we do. I believe that the area of what we're doing with water is really susceptible going forward for us if we don't start doing something quite differently. So the ethanol, and this is an industry we've been spending lots of time and effort trying to get the yields up, take care of some of the factors that keep farmers from growing corn, sorghum. Corn has done such a great job in increasing yields, ease of production, and everybody likes to look at it. It's quite pretty. So it's a really a major challenge. But for our state, it's important that we do this one thing, because if you look at the ethanol standards, we have overcapacity ethanol industry in the United States, and the margins are going to be very bad. But the sorghum industry has a great potential because advanced biofuels at times get from 50 to 75 cents a gallon premium, sometimes up to a buck, divided by 2.8 is 30, 40 cents a bushel for the sorghum. Water, major concern in Kansas, is one of the key legs of our three-legged stool of agriculture. One of my jobs, and I manage over 42,000 individual water rights, individual contracts with individuals that were developed under Western water law over the last 30, 40 years, and were over-appropriated. With the drought and high-priced corn, I describe things as the water wars, because it's not a daily issue that I'm not dealing with. In addition, we manage the reservoirs in the state in the way of water releases, sales, people pumping out of rivers, junior water rights. We have cities fighting each other for water. Some want to buy it, some steal it when it comes by. And then we have some cities that have not done a very good job even planning for the water. So as a result of that, the governor has kicked off a water initiative to say, where are we going to be 50 years from now in water? And we're going to be very actively doing this in the next year and a piece, to define what we got to do to go forward. Because without water, especially in our western part of the state, we will be a Dust Bowl dry farming, growing maybe wheat every other year with a fallow program, which we were doing in the 30s and the 40s. the total, that ag district in western Kansas is the largest economic ag district in the United States in dollars of volume that comes out of it, primarily because our corn packing industry, cattle feeding industry. So what we do here, this is really, water is really across the world, especially those that pump from an aquifer, is really the tragedy of the commons. And if you haven't studied it, you should. It's an issue that there, long as there's no value on that water, there's no incentive to conserve it. So the issue is, how do you put the true value on it going forward? We in Kansas, in order to promote growth and jobs, took all the income taxes off of farmers and ranchers 2 years ago. We took the income taxes off of LLCs and subchapter S corporations in order trying to create growth. We reduced personal income taxes from 6.2 to 3.9, and our objective and plan is to go forward all the way to zero income taxes for all in the state of Kansas sometime in the future. We studied this issue quite extensively. If you look at the growth across the United States, where there are no income taxes is where the growth has been in the last few years. So it's either that the income taxes are creating no growth or the people are going there because they don't have income taxes. I don't know. I really don't care. But the issue is we're making a major effort, and we want to be the first state ever to do that. So this is, and the purpose is to take those funds that have been going to the income taxes to get them reinvested back into a piece of machinery, a piece of equipment, and create more jobs. One of the interesting things we're doing this year is we're moving our state headquarters to Manhattan, Kansas, next to the Kansas State University. We're building a new building, which we'll be moving into May next year. This is something I never thought I'd ever get done, but I convinced the legislators to let me leave. And this is very interesting. We looked at South Dakota, New Mexico, and Indiana with Purdue has this type of relationship with the university. If you look at the Ag Department, we're the only state agency that is sector-driven. We work for Ag, and we work for Ag. Commerce is commerce, labor is labor, but we work for Ag. And the center of Ag is our agriculture research station, and we spend a lot of time there anyway. So this move is going on. It's somewhat controversial. Some days the IT people are giving me fits right now. You know, there's a lot of ways to stop things and or slow it down, but we're going to get this one done. And the end result is, I think that in the synergy between us and the university will be much greater and much better going forward. So one of the questions was asked to us today is how do we relate to ag farm journalism? And I thought about that question just a minute, and I said, well, what's my job? And I think maybe our jobs are much very similar, you know. Sometimes we're not always on the same side, but we have access to the farmers. We all have to be very open and honest and sincere what we do, and we really have to understand the industry that we support. And so when we look at that, I think that we really, our jobs are very similar. I work for the people of the state of Kansas. I serve at the pleasure of the governor, but I work for you as well. Thank you.
Dale, Greg, Karen, Doug, Michael, great job. I just have a feeling NASDA meetings are pretty interesting.
When you all, to say the least,
more than welcome to come.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of a lot like farm broadcaster meeting. I think we do have a lot in common, Dale, actually. I do want to throw this out because I think it touches everybody's state here, whether it be Kansas, Nebraska, California, North Dakota, or Louisiana. But I want to start in California. I just want to throw this out. I don't think any of you touched on a key issue I know is important to you and your states and your agriculture, and that's the immigration issue.
Yes.
You touched on that labor a little bit, but I'd like to get your thoughts real quick from each of you, how that's impacting your state's agriculture, the situation is right now, and what steps would best fix it or address it in your states. And we'll start with California and kind of go out from there because we know it's a key issue, front burner issue there, but as it is for their states. But Karen, if you would.
Yeah, we desperately do need immigration reform as long as it has the ag jobs, the partnership that was created between the unions, the faith community, and the agribusiness community over the last 10 years has created a very workable guest worker program that works for agriculture and for the seasonal issues that we have, the housing transportation issues that we have in rural areas. The biggest change I have seen, how that has impacted us, because we have historically been so dependent on hand labor, is the changing in varietals that are being planted. When I look at how many more almond trees are going in than table grape vineyards, for example, I believe one of the issues that those people were considering was need for labor and how mechanized they were. We unfortunately have a history in this country where there were a couple decades where investment by USDA, for example, in mechanization was prohibited. And that really has hurt us, but we've accelerated the work on mechanization. Sensor technology, robotic technology. I never thought I'd see the day that our strawberry industry, which is huge in California, and probably with fresh produce in the Salinas Valley, is most dependent on hand labor, is in their third year of developing a prototype robotic harvester for strawberries. So that's the biggest change you will see that frees people up to use their minds for the jobs that are being created. And I really commend you for your work on exposing people to the career. So mechanization, I think, is where we've seen the biggest change.
Doug, what about North Dakota?
Well, we certainly have labor issues, first and foremost, because of all the activity in the state. We have some of the lowest unemployment in the nation. We have 13,000 to 16,000 job openings, even up to 30-some thousand job openings in any given week over the last couple of years. But when it comes to agriculture, we probably have suffered at the worst because our jobs aren't as high paying. So it's been a concern. We do have issues with H-2A. We want to see it streamlined. We want to see it really addressed, primarily because in most of agriculture, which is mechanized, you can have larger equipment. You can have less people on the farm doing some of that work. But when it comes to animal agriculture, you need a warm body that has a judgment aspect to it to care for and manage animals and livestock. You can't get that with machines. I mean, we got some robotic milkers now in the dairy industry, but it still doesn't replace the fact you need a warm person, a warm body to do the work.
Michael, Louisiana.
When you look at Louisiana, we use probably one of the highest per capitas of H-2B in the nation. We're very high on H-2B. We have a very small amount of, quote, illegal immigrants that work in Louisiana. What is happening now, because with the ongoing battle in H-2A and H-2B specifically, has become so difficult to where we're starting to see that many of the industries, our fruit and vegetable industry and others, going to Mexico, going elsewhere. The entities are closing. But also now with technology, our farmers are embracing technology. And I will give you for instance, our sweet potato farmers have recently brought in equipment from Europe to harvest sweet potatoes mechanically. We're looking at all types of robotics. And what's happening because of the farmers being put into almost impossible situation with the regulations of H-2B and then H-2A in that order and the tremendous pressures under the federal government, they are actively investing in different types of mechanical infrastructure. That being said, those jobs, once replaced, will not return. And so what is happening in this ongoing debate of immigration, I'm an advocate of separating the H-2A, H-2B issue from the immigration issues, dealing with them separately. But what we're going to do, if we're not careful in the agricultural sector, is buy mechanization and then higher prices to pay for that mechanization. You're going to have an entire group of people that will be non-employed and permanently unemployed because those jobs will not be there. And so it is a big issue for us. But I can tell you that we are leaning back, but the federal government has made it so very difficult for our farmers to deal with these issues to where many of them, especially the older generations, they say, you know what, we're done. And the younger generation says, you know, I can go be a veterinarian and have a better lifestyle or something else. And so it's had a very negative impact, this ongoing battle, and we rely on those H-2B and H-2A workers in that order tremendously. But you know what, we're finding other ways to do it.
Greg, what are you seeing in Nebraska?
Well, I think several things. First of all, profitability in agriculture has, made it so the next generation is looking to return to the farm. Mm-hmm. And so mom and dad have children that are now once again interested in coming back and being part of running that farm operation, and that's positive. I think one of the things we're learning more and more and seeing as a challenge is the labor that we do hire on the farm because of the technical nature of farming and livestock production today. We need our labor to have some type of a technical education. And I think that's part of our message to students as well, that, you know, maybe you don't need a four-year degree. Maybe there's a place to get a two-year degree that will allow you to, up your skills and be more valuable employees and also focus in better on what you're really interested in doing. And then finally, we do have a lot of Hispanic labor in our feedlots and our livestock operations across Nebraska. It just seems mind-boggling that, when my wife's grandparents came to America, they could go through Ellis Island and people could, with a pad of paper and a pencil, keep track of the people coming into the United States and document them and give them some type of credentials that made them legal immigrants. And today we can put an electronic EID tag in a cow and track her all over the world if we needed to, but we can't figure out how to move people in and out of the United States. And so, you know, that's somewhere where Congress needs to put their nose to the grindstone, and they need to figure out the solution to the problem. I'm not advocating any specific solution, but we need a solution.
We're technically smart and common sense dumb, it seems like, in a lot of ways. Dale in Kansas?
Well, like all things, I jumped into this one real early, and I've been kind of beat down a couple, three, four times. I went to Washington to Homeland Security three different times. Kansas has a, probably in western Kansas, 50,000 illegals working in the animal industry, the dairy industry, the beef industry, the feed yards, and we have about 25,000 people that work in our packing houses. And so most of those are carry papers or at least illegal. However, I went to Washington, and my first genius idea was, let's make a new Ellis Island out in Garden City, Kansas, and let me run it. And I thought I just, I told Homeland Security, you got this so screwed up that you let me go do this out here, and I'll show you how we can do it at the local level. And if it gets screwed up, you can blame me. And if it works, well, you can take the model and take it up to Nebraska, you know. And we actually had a whole plan put together where we were going to have the churches and the schools involved. We had the employers paying into it. We had the employees paying a fee. And we were going to manage the database and run that. But that was really too simple for somebody to accept, and I agree with it, what Greg says about tracking people going forward. They're not all Hispanics. We have a large group of German immigrants in western Kansas that came across the border a number of years ago from Canada, walked into western Kansas and worked there, and I'm sure that's true in other states. And met a kid graduating out of high school the other day, German, on the athletic team, can't get a driver's license, can't do anything, you know. And we're tightening that down within the state. Been to Puerto Rico recruiting people. They have about 16% unemployment rate. We thought maybe they might want to come to western Kansas, which, like North Dakota, not quite like North Dakota, but we don't have any unemployment out there at all. We have a small fracking industry, and they came in and raised the rates, and so we lost about a big chunk of our cattle riders, pen riders, as a result of that. They'll be back because the fracking is slowing down a little bit on that. But okay. It needs to be fixed. It's complex problems have simple solutions. And we must always remember that. And this is a simple solution issue.
Karen, I did a broadcast from your state talking with some of your fruit and vegetable growers, and to hear them sit there and say, we can't harvest our crops because we don't have the workers. That's a very sad situation. And it's hard to get people to understand that. The rest of the country, you say, oh, those immigrants are taking all these jobs like they're Americans are lining up to take them, and we're not seeing that, obviously. Okay, we don't have too much time left, but anybody, a question from out there and directed towards any of our panelists here? I know that you'll probably want to come up and get interviews afterwards.
This is your big shot now.
Yeah. Frank A., go ahead, Don.
Secretary Ross, talking about the dairy industry, you were mentioning briefly that next year perhaps we can look at an overhaul. I know this past year it was trying to do a temporary help, cheese making, milk processing, that end of it. Anything you might be able to add about possible ideas as opposed to saying we're going to look at it again?
The continuation of World War III between the processors and the producers would be a good thing to end. Well, we do have the cooperative. We have three major cooperatives in the state, and several of the producer groups are trying to craft a petition to go into a federal order. One of the issues that's challenging for that is that we have a quota system that actually allows for it's too complex to get into. Anyhow, quota itself, which gives a premium to a bunch of the milk right off the bat out of our pool, is not necessarily something that can be transferred into the federal order, and other states don't have it, so that's a challenge. What we're trying to do at the state level is really look at the pricing mechanism on the manufactured milk class. 4A is butter and powders, and 4B is cheese. We've gotten really good at making those products because we have milked so many cows that when we started our pooling program, 60% of our milk was utilized for fluid milk, which is the highest value category, that was sold to citizens of the state of California. Today, that's less than 14%. 80% of our milk utilization is going into manufactured product, so that we are the cheese makers of the world, the powder makers of the world, the butter makers of the world, but we aren't investing in the technology to extract all the value from the isolates, the proteins, the whey products themselves. And so we've got to find a way to free up some capital to invest in the processing part of that and really allow those products, because they're now in a storable manner, to be able to generate enough revenues to equitably reward both the processor who invests in the technology and the milk producer who's seeing so much of their milk go into that category. So that's really where we're focusing on, is on the manufactured class.
Dale?
I think a couple things are happening in the milk, and gosh, I'm glad I don't have to manage it. But if you look at the world price of milk, it's being pretty well set by the New Zealand auction market, which happens twice every other week. And if you plot that against milk prices across the world, it's become very similar. Secondly, I believe that European dairies are going to take their subsidies off of dairies in a couple of three years. At that point, this whole thing's going to change again, probably to the United States' advantage, because we have such low cost of production of food and food cost for the cattle and for raising the cattle and our productivity. But, really, if we get rid of the milk pricing system totally, we would lose a lot of small dairies, without a question. But we would be very, very competitive and be very beneficial across the world. Now, the robotic milkers are really kind of nice because all they cost about $160,000, and I think it's 60 cows a robot. A farmer, small dairy, can buy two of them today, and he can go to town on Saturday night. And European dairies don't even build a dairy today without all robotic milkers.
Actually, I want to go to his state and buy the milkers, because ours cost $250,000 and they do about 75 cows.
Wow.
Well, I can give you some help here. Just come on down.
Get you a discount,
he gets
right?
His from eBay.
Yeah.
If you look at our situation, and this is just an overall comment about how efficient production agriculture has become in the United States, but in the world. But back in 1960, we had 19.2 million head of cattle, dairy livestock, in the United States producing 123 billion pounds of milk. Just 2 years ago, we were showing numbers. Actually, it was last year, showing numbers of 9.1 million head of cattle. So we dropped over 10 million head of cattle of dairy livestock, and we're now producing 200 billion pounds of milk. These guys have done a fantastic job with nutrition, setting up the systems, maintaining health of the animal, and to their own detriment, supplying a market that doesn't have a whole lot of elasticity in it.
Which is why we're debating supply management in the Dairy Security Act,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Hey, we're out of time, and we've got to stay on schedule. We have a break coming up sponsored by the Katz Radio Group, and, of course, Secretary Vilsack is going to be here at 4 o'clock. I want to thank Dale Rodman from Kansas, Greg Ibach from Nebraska, Karen Ross. Look how I'm doing this. Karen Ross from California, Doug Goring from North Dakota. I shouldn't have looked at those papers. Just done it. And Michael Strain from Louisiana. You know, just go with what you know. Hey, we've got gifts from NAFB for each of you. Be sure to grab it. I know these folks want to come and talk to you afterwards. Great discussion. It's interesting to learn, isn't it, what each can do or can't do with the powers that they're given in their state and the different authorities and regulations that they are dealing with. We thank you. And thank you for being available to farm broadcasters. We appreciate it very much.